You're listening to Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM, RadioSandySprings.com on the internet, and it's time now for Inside the Black Box, and we've got them both here today.
You make that sound like a bad thing, Dave.
It's a good thing.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Inside the Black Box, Radio Sandy Springs' weekly program on science and technology. Certainly now that Bill Hunt, my co-host, is back in the studio, it's not only science and technology, it's science only funnier. Bill, welcome back after your two-week hiatus.
Thank you.
Good so to be back. Where were you? Vegas, Atlantic City?
The story is I gave an invited talk at Dalhousie University in Halifax, and then scampered up to our home up in Cape Breton, and it was very difficult. I was eating lobster every other day. It's just arduous conditions up in the frozen tundra.
But the scary thing is you were all alone without spousal supervision, I understand.
Right. All I had was cheap VHS movies of questionable sexual content.
Oh,
for
I see.
$350. That's all.
And I found this out accidentally because there is. What's the official term for this meeting of the minds you have every week? Is it actually beer club?
Yeah, beer club. Yes, okay. Right.
Which I'm
started
flattered.
By a German guy, by the way. Who would have thunk it?
So I was talking to somebody on the Georgia Tech faculty, and they said, "Yeah, I was talking to Bill Hunt's wife. Does she occasionally go to beer club?"
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said I thought she'd be up in Nova Scotia at your cabin up there, and apparently she wasn't invited.
Yeah.
All right, well, it's good to have you back nonetheless.
Yeah, she was invited.
But she said, I'm not going to spend a week with that guy.
We tried that whole thing of leaving the kids at home alone with, you know, like a bowl of food on the floor like you do with
much
the dog.
Much like the dog, yeah.
The neighbors complained.
How old are your kids?
They're 11 and 13.
Okay, well, 13, you know, my daughter's going to turn 12.
Well, at this point, they'd have a rave at the house.
Oh, you're right. So 13 is too old.
Chicks over and, you
right.
know.
Right, the cops would be called.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, so before we get into today's topic, which has to deal with electronic voting, and our guest, in just a minute we'll bring him up, is Garland Favorito, who is an expert on this topic, and we'll explore his background and his relation to electronic voting in Georgia and in the United States in general. But first, let's recap last week's show, which was on the origins of life. Our guest was Professor Nick Hudd from the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Georgia Tech, who actually talked to us about some amazing things that I was not aware of. He's actually working on molecules he calls molecular midwives, which are molecules that essentially assist RNA from replicating itself.
I dated one of those in college, by the way.
Indeed you did. And I asked him, why do we have midwives and no mid-husbands?
Yeah.
Yet there's animal husbandry, but no animal wifery.
Yeah, we got to correct these things.
Yeah, and animal husbandry, that just sounds like an uncomfortable situation down in rural Georgia, but we're not going to go into that. So Nick Hudd was our guest, and he talked to us about his new research, which, by the way, there's a link to on the website if you're interested, on these molecular midwives that can get RNA to self-replicate itself 10,000 times faster than without these molecules, indicating that, you know, maybe these molecules were involved in the first reproduction of RNA and then eventually DNA from that. And one thing I learned that was very interesting is the sugars that RNA and DNA are made of, right? We call them ribose nucleic acid, deoxyribose. That just means you've yanked an oxygen off of it. Ribose is just like hexose. Hexose are, you know, glucose, fructose, things like that. These sugars spontaneously synthesize under the right conditions with a lot of cyanide. I did not know this. And apparently there was a lot of cyanide in the primordial conditions of the planet. So I worried, you know, you can get them to polymerize, great, but how do you get the original, you know, monomer, the original building block for these things? And apparently that comes out quite easily. Hmm. So that's certainly something I learned that was very interesting. All right, so as we often do, let's start with a little bit of science in the news. From the Tuesday Science Times section of the New York Times, this, of course, would be Tuesday, October 24th. Just when you thought having AIDS was maybe the worst thing you could have, in an article by Donald G. McNeil, Jr., entitled Worrisome New Links, Link, AIDS, Drugs, and Leprosy, your life just got worse. Yeah. And apparently one of the problems is that, you know, a lot of the cases of AIDS are in third world countries. And leprosy, believe it or not, which is, you know, not really through, you know, sort of this viral immune system interruption mechanism. It's actually a bacterial infection that you can cure with very, very... rigorous
drugs.
Antibiotics. Are we being sarcastic already?
No, actually, it is very low cost.
Supposedly Novartis Pharmaceuticals basically gives these things away. So when you pay for them, you're really paying for sort of a handling fee.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as, you know, I'm not a huge fan of large drug companies, at least with regard to leprosy, you know, kudos to Novartis and other companies that give that sort of medication away. But it's interesting that now we're trying to do the same thing with AIDS drugs, right? All these HIV protease inhibitors and these various combinations of drugs. And the article goes on to say that with affordable AIDS drugs arriving in many poor countries, experts say a startling and worrisome side effect has emerged. In some patients, the treatment uncovers a hidden leprosy infection. Because it's messing with your immune system,
right?
You know, hopefully bolstering it to some degree. And in fact, they find that a lot of these things pop up. So if you see these bizarre sort of, you lose feeling in your extremities, mm-hmm. and you start to see sort of necrotic type behavior,
right.
It could very well be that they've actually found some cases in Europe and the United States. That's rare. Most of them are in third world countries.
Note to self, stop vacationing at leprosy colonies.
Yeah, that's probably not good. I'm surprised they would let you into places like that anyway. And then the cover story in the Science Times from Tuesday was Rays and Neutrons for Art's Sake by William J. Broad. And they actually spend more time talking about the art part of it. But essentially, they're using a new neutron bombardment technique to analyze the elemental makeup of works of art.
Hmm.
And actually, the motivating story was a statue that they weren't sure was from the cathedral in Sens, France, or directly from Notre Dame in Paris. And in fact, you can take this stone or pottery or whatever it is, grind it up, bombard it with neutrons. And of course, we actually talked about that last week when we talked about element 118, the largest element ever made. It's yet to be confirmed, but both scientists from the United States and Russia actually supposedly made that. What makes these things so heavy, of course, is more protons and more neutrons. But what's nice is you can take a neutron, shoot it into this material, and then look at the decay via gamma radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And that decay will be different. The frequency of the gamma rays and things like that will be different depending on whether you've got certain heavy elements like manganese, iron, even lighter elements like sodium. And what they're able to do is look at exactly the elemental makeup of these statues. And if they're drastically different, that means the stone came from a different quarry or the pottery was made out of different clays and things like that. They've also used it to analyze pottery from the Tang Dynasty in China. And in fact, I believe they were able to figure out which cathedral this thing actually came from. So that's kind of neat. And, you know, just to go into the background of that just a little bit, for example, we had Alan Tannenbaum on a couple months ago now, talking about nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. And that takes advantage of the fact that even though carbon, which we think of as element number 12, it does not have, or rather element number 6, it's got 6 proteins, it does not have a molecular weight of exactly double that, 6 protons and 6 neutrons. That's the most common form, carbon 12, and that decays over billions and billions of years. But carbon 13, actually, because it's got an odd number, you can use for this nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy like they do in MRI imaging. And then finally, carbon 14, which is something a lot of us are familiar with, decays much quicker over hundreds of thousands of years, which means you can see how it changes over tens of thousands of years, and that's exactly how carbon dating works, very similar to this sort of thing. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back after a few minutes with our guest, Garland Favorito, to discuss electronic voting security issues. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking about electronic voting security issues. And if you're very interested in making a comment or have a question for our guest, Garland Favorito, about this very controversial issue, by all means, give us a call locally at 404-943-1620 or toll-free at 866-356-0789. And, of course, both those numbers are listed on our website if you're listening to streaming audio at www.radiosandysprings.com. And now, Bill, a little about our guest, Garland Favorito.
Yes, Garland is an independent computer consultant, so this gives him the technical background to look at some of these things. He became concerned about government corruption after viewing and verifying the accuracy of videos about the murders of Vince Foster, Kevin Ives, and Don Henry, when he realized that a cover-up of these and other serious crimes were linked to Clinton administration people. He planned and helped organize America's first national impeachment town hall after the Republican leadership protected Bill Clinton from facing the more serious charges that initiated the impeachment movement. Garland decided to find out why his remarkable findings are published in a book, Our Nation Betrayed, available from Epic Books. You can call 888-808-5440 to get that. And of late, he's been very interested in the electronic voting and the issues there. And this is from an article, November 3rd, 2004, an inside story of how 2 million Georgia voters have been disenfranchised. And I'll read a little bit of that. Imagine living in a state where the Secretary of State was repeatedly on public record as opposing verifiable, auditable elections. Imagine also that no citizen in the state can verify whether or not his or her vote in an election was recorded correctly. Imagine still that no poll worker in the state can audit whether or not votes were summarized correctly at a precinct, city, or state levels. Imagine further that the state has no capability for an election recount, but only a reprint of election results.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. Yeah, it's almost Halloween. Yeah. That is a scary scenario.
Yeah.
So, Garland, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much for being here. The scariest part of that is it's actually true. So.
It is, indeed. And before we actually get into it, let me point out that the mm-hmm. book that Bill described, there is a link to that on Amazon.com on the website. And there's also a link to the article he just quoted from. So if you're interested in the details of these things, you can go to Radio Sandy Springs, click on our show. There's a link to all the shows, and there's a lovely, somewhat dated picture of Garland on the thing. It's a nice photo.
When he was three.
And you can look all this.
He's got the cowboy outfit on. And right.
This issue has aged me a lot.
Right. So before we get started, it seems to me that I can make the claim that this is not a partisan issue.
Yes.
Right?
Well, that's right. I actually got involved in all that history there that Bill described. I felt like there was some collusion between Democrats and Republicans, mm-hmm. and this kind of carries forward into the electronic voting.
As there is in electronic voting, which you point out in that article.
Exactly. And it is a nonpartisan issue because we have support in the legislature from both sides, mm-hmm. the Democrats and Republicans, and we also have resistance mm-hmm. in the legislature from both sides.
Right.
Democrats and Republicans.
So what are the biggest security issues that we should be worried about with electronic voting?
Well, we believe that the primary issues are that you cannot verify, audit, or recount an election. Mm-hmm. So what do I mean by that? That means that you as the voter cannot verify that the votes that you cast on your ballot were actually cast as you selected the candidates. You can't confirm that the ballot was ever physically cast because your ballot has now been redefined as an electronic record,
right.
which you cannot access. You cannot participate in counting the results to make sure that they're accurate or even audit them because they're not auditable. And the reason that they're not auditable is because the new machines and the way in which they were implemented don't capture any direct physical evidence of voter intent anymore. So if you wanted to do a recount, which they did up here in Cherokee County recently, you can't recount. You can only reprint the previous unverifiable results. Mm-hmm. So what went wrong was that the chain of custody was broken between the voter and the ballot, whereas prior to the electronic voting implementation, you had a punch card or a optical scan ballot, which you could see the selections on. Now all that's been taken away from you and put inside the black box because the government will tell you, okay, you cast this vote here. They'll show you the screen, but you don't know what's on the screen is actually on that
little card
record. So we are the government. Yeah. We trust us to cast your votes correctly.
And I know when I vote, you take that little electronic card and you turn it to someone who puts it in a machine that records it. I'm not only concerned about the fact that you're right. I have no idea what's on that card. I have no idea what's actually being recorded. But also, The guy that I hand it to, usually a volunteer poll worker, very conscientious, you know, out there doing their civic duty, is usually close to 100 years old. You seen these guys?
Yeah.
They can barely give you that "I'm a Georgia voter" sticker.
It's right.
Like, yeah, I'm worried there may be an accident there, or they just
spill Geritol on the car.
Yeah, like prune juice or something.
Yeah.
So, so agreed. So, I'm concerned about this as well. How do we mediate this problem?
Well, we have tried a variety of solutions. Historically, I'll try. That's kind of a long question, but let me try to summarize it quickly. Basically,
you don't need to answer it in 5 minutes.
Okay.
We can take some time.
Okay. We started with trying to mediate it with the Secretary of State. Actually, we started even before that. We started before these machines were ever purchased. Mm-hmm. And I wrote, I was a computer, you know, you said I was a computer expert. Actually, you know, X and Spur, that means X is washed up, Spur, little drip under pressure.
Right.
So I was washed up, little drip under pressure. But anyway, I, being in the computer business, I knew when these were under evaluation that there were some problems, because I'd actually been tipped off myself as to what could happen, and then verified those problems being in the computer business and found that, yes, it's very true, you could have unverifiable voting. Just as we have here. So I wrote to the elections officials who were evaluating the machines back in 2002, I explained that these machines do not have any audit trails to verify the votes, and the results are subject to manipulation. And the response I got back, this was from the assistant elections director and the professor who headed the evaluation out in Kennesaw State. And basically they told me that, well, the areas of concern are that you raise are thoroughly protected against by federally certified systems, which, being the computer business, I knew was totally false. And once again, we rely on the federal government to do something that they're unable to do. But anyway...
So, no, Bill's ready to pounce.
So we went from there. We went to the elections officials after they purchased the machines. They ignored us at that time.
Officials, you're talking about the Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of State, professor who headed the evaluations, like previous elections director. We didn't get any help there. In fact, we got amazing, unimaginable resistance, and still do even to this day, from the elections director and Secretary of State.
And resistance exactly to what? Were there changes you wanted to make, or you wanted a new evaluation?
Well,
resistance to discussions? I mean, what?
Yeah. We even suggested, a lot of us are in the computer business, we offered to literally to reprogram the existing machines, using the existing printers, let them print the ballots out, let the voters drop the ballots into the boxes, and we would donate the software to the state at no charge.
So you were advocating setting it up for a paper trail?
Absolutely. Yes. And, of course, you have to have a paper trail, an audit trail, and you also have to use that audit trail to make sure that the machines count right on election night.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a sticking point as well, because they, that takes some effort on part of these 100-year-old poll workers that you mentioned, too.
Let's not knock them. I mean, they're doing a civic.
A heck of a job.
They really are.
Right. Yeah.
It was just a cheap joke. That's all, It's early. We got to be a little
right. Yeah, we'll bring them up to 50 cents instead of the 25 cents.
That's right. And as you said, I mean, the poll workers are pretty much, they're just handed these procedures and these methods. So,
right.
And they're stuck with them, even though, and some of them don't agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing they can do. So anyway, we went on to, actually went to the state election board, and this was another interesting proposition where we said, you've got the $17 million allocated that the Secretary of State says we needed for the audit trails. Let's spend it. And they said, well, we want to buy electronic poll books instead. And now, the day that they passed that...
What is that?
What is an electronic poll
book? Electronic poll book is when you walk into the poll, you know, they used to look your name up in a book. Now they look it up on the computer. I remember testifying that day along with everybody else who testified opposed that. And I said, well, look, you know, there's no lines in my precinct. We don't need to have a... the poll books to reduce the lines. What we need to do is make sure our votes are actually being counted correctly. So take the money that you're going to allocate for this and spend it on the audit trails, which Secretary of State says needs to be used to have body secure printers, because they didn't want our original solution. So they ignored us and voted to buy the poll books, and that made us very, very pleased. So we worked the legislature.
It's the first official sarcasm of the program.
So we worked the legislature for a couple of years. We've gotten some support. We have two bipartisan bills down there, one in the House, one in the Senate, and they did not quite get through this time. And we felt like, we got a pilot project through, and I'll tell you about that. But there's a lot of problems with that. So anyway, that's where we ended up. We couldn't get it through, so we had to file suit.
Hey, I've got a quick question for you. From what you're saying, I used to. At times represent a few politicians, and it was very easy back in several years ago that you could buy your mailing list by Democratic or Republican mailing list. Mm-hmm. Are you saying the way it is today that you can't, unless they vote a straight ticket or something? Or
I'm sorry, you can't do what?
Buy a mailing list. If you're running for office, you used to be able to buy a Republican mailing list from your district or whatever.
Meaning in terms of registered voters.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Has this done away with, and it stated basically that in the last election you voted Republican or you voted for this candidate, which was a Republican, so you could buy that name.
Yeah, I don't think it really had any impact on that. I think the registered voting lists are still available. This is just basically...
Well, yeah, it's based on how you registered. How you voted, it's based on how you registered.
Okay.
Right. And, yeah, if that was public knowledge back then, I can't see why it wouldn't be public knowledge now.
Yeah, I don't
now.
Think that's been perturbed.
Right.
But it could be if you go to this electronic poll book.
Well, right, which is interesting, where they now, in a recent court case, indicate that they could determine how someone voted based on their name and their precinct, which this is actually unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. You have to maintain signature of the ballot.
Well, to that end, you were talking about the Secretary of State's office and Kathy Cox. It's my understanding that, based on everything I've read, Kathy Cox, when she was Secretary of State, which is current, never once advocated paper trails and things like that. And I'll tell you right now, in case Kathy Cox is listening, that's why I didn't vote for her, you know, in the governor primary, because to me that was just an absolute. And, of course, all the candidates for Secretary of State, every single one of them on both sides were saying paper trails, verifiable. They mm-hmm. were advocating all this sort of stuff. So I hope maybe it'll become easier now.
Well, I think we need to take a commercial break.
Well, actually, we've got a caller on the line. If you'd like, you want to talk.
Okay,
sure, why not?
Sure.
Good morning. You're on Inside the Black Box. Do you have a question or comment about electronic voting?
Yes. First of all, this is Nan Garrett with the Georgia Green Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say good morning.
Welcome.
Morning.
The first question is this, when you were talking earlier about how they changed the law, I wanted to point out that not only did they do what Garland said, they redefined our ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Our ballot used to be defined a certain way where we knew we had a tangible item.
Right.
And now they've redefined that to where legally, even if you want to challenge it in the courts, it's these bytes and bits that right. no one can see and touch. And that may not sound significant to the average voter, but when it comes to challenging election, it is very significant.
Right. Well, actually, to geeks like Bill and I, it is significant. So you're saying they've changed the definition mm-hmm. under the law of a ballot. And the ballot can be, you know, some record in a computer file. Exactly what you mean by the bits and bytes.
Well, they allege that it's a record in a computer file, but no one's yet proven mm-hmm. this to us, and I've been active with Garland on this as well.
Mm-hmm.
No one's proven to us that, in fact, that it is an electronic recording individually for each voter.
That's right. And Nan is a former gubernatorial candidate mm-hmm. for the Green Party, and she's been working on this for years. And as she's saying... we believe that that's unconstitutional because mm-hmm. We don't think the constitutional framers ever believed that a ballot was something that was totally inaccessible,
right.
that you could not view the selections on your own ballot or yeah. ever determine that it was physically cast.
Right.
So I was just mentioning at the end there that we were filing a suit, and one of the counts of that suit, this is a suit that we're bringing by voterga.org,
right. Which is on the website, by the way, if you want to access that.
Great. And yeah, and we are going to challenge that very exactly what Nan has said,
mm-hmm.
Hopefully the judge will have to rule whether or not that is in fact constitutional.
Right.
There also is an illegality issue that they, when redefining it, we think that may also be illegal as well. But
right. Right. I certainly think from a technology standpoint, it's scary because it's so easily changed. I guess.
Right.
Paper is a little harder to change.
Well, and you know, if you had, you know, it doesn't have to have your name on it, and you could have an optical scanner.
Right.
So at the end of the day, at each pole, optical scanner, what does that come out with? How does that compare with an independent machine? The scanner can be offline, completely electrically unconnected to the other one.
Right.
You know, do these match up or do they not match up? If they don't match up, you still got the paper to go back to.
All right. Well, Nan, we certainly agree. And thanks very much for the comment. We need to take a quick break. And after the commercial break, we'll continue this discussion on security issues and electronic voting. All right. Good morning and welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with our guest, Garland Favorito, about security issues in electronic voting. And when we last left, we were confronting the issues of now your ballot may be defined as bits and bytes in a computer file. And why is that a problem?
Well, if you talk about the scientific method, any experiment that you do, the ideal situation is to have a completely independent method to confirm what you saw.
Right.
So, you know, there's fluorescent imaging and some of the biology. So you go, well, I think this is happening, and I've got this image that it's happening by this fluorescence, so this gives me more of a positive feeling that I'm seeing what I think I'm seeing.
Oh, right. You measured by two or more independent means.
Right. And so having the printed copy that can be optically scanned and you've got the electronic database recording, you have independent methods. You can have the scanner completely offline from the other machine so they're not interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at them and go, okay, these match, so I'm pretty sure within a few votes here or there, because there always is some error, that I've got the right vote.
Right.
You would never do science this way where you just measure one thing and you don't measure anything else and say, Eureka, I've got it.
And then you publish it so that other groups can verify it as well.
Right.
And until they do, or if they de-verify it, then you print a retraction and things are ugly. But back to the caller, Nan, who brought up the issue of, you know, that supposedly you're not defining, you're not just accumulating the accounts in the electronic files, you're putting each individual one in there. And that is supposedly the new electronic definition of your ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you do that, that scares me because what's different about the paper ballot, which is in a box and has to be counted and there's physical evidence and people can see it, what bothers me is the fact that even if you have in a precinct, you know, 500,000 records and you can go in and print them out and look at them, changing them is so much easier than changing the paper. The ballot, paper ballot, you have to take 500,000 ballots and physically change them. Electronic,
or go lose it, like in the Kennedy Nixon election in Chicago in 1960.
They went through efforts to commit voter fraud. Then.
Well, and if the mafia,
those were Democrats, by the way.
Yeah, and if the mafia hadn't, you know, basically stolen the ballot boxes in those precincts, Nixon would have been president in 60.
Yeah, I mean, Illinois.
That was a very, very close election, and.
But now you write a three-line script that will change these votes however you want, and the script runs in a microsecond. Mm-hmm. That's what scares me.
And
I'd rather have guys with machine guns, you know, doing a little bit of damage than a couple of geeks.
Right, right.
You know, doing a lot of damage.
So Garland's point is well taken, that when you change the bits and bytes, it's digital. It can get copied. There's no record of that change, whereas if you physically change a ballot, there's marks, there's folds, there's pen marks, there's something. You can look for fraud.
Fingerprints.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think to the bottom line is that a single individual could literally control the outcome of any Georgia election undetectable.
Right.
Are these wireless funnels? Are the voting machines wireless?
The voting machines are they're standalone.
Right.
Well, let's
might want to explain how you transmit your vote from the machine.
Why don't you go through the whole thing of how. And before I say this, let me say that I called Diebold no less than six times, and we'll get them to call you, and nothing. They never call me back and told me, sorry, we're only going to speak to Fox News or CNN. Nothing. So that makes me very suspicious that they're not even going to say, look, here's what the situation is. I mean, some foreign power could hack into it and change it.
But you were polite and professional, right? You didn't call up and say, this is the hot girl chat line, is it?
Have you ever known me not to be polite and professional.
No, Bill,
of course not.
That would be the second official sarcasm.
Right,
the show.
Right, yeah. But anyway, why don't you go through for the listeners what, so I vote. How does that, is it transmitted over the internet? Is somebody, you know, drive it downtown in a car or what happens?
Right. Well, the votes, of course, are on the smart cards, and then they also supposedly have a backup in the machine. To go to the question of wireless, it's not, there's some big questions now as to whether or not they actually have wireless capabilities built into them as well, and some have found to actually have that, which means that they could be manipulated undetectably. So the smart cards then are then taken by each precinct to the county, and then they're accumulated there. And the
when I do my voting on the touchscreen, and I get this little card, and then when I'm done voting, mm-hmm. it pops the card out, and I take the vote and the card and give it to that 100-year-old poll worker. They just collect the cards, or do they accumulate them there?
Well, no, I'm sorry. You're right, Pete. They actually do accumulate them there at the precinct as well, and the way they do that is they go from machine to machine and taking the cards up, and then one machine becomes accumulator.
Yeah, and I've seen them plug it in there and accumulate it. Yeah.
And that's how they get the precinct totals, and they print the precinct totals out, and if they're following the law, they'll post those on the door. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they'll post them in a manner in which you could actually see the individual counts for the races and so on. Mm-hmm. And then they will take those to the county.
Okay. And the first issue I think we see is you get that card, and it's not a punch card where you at least feel physically good mm-hmm. that, you know, you punched the right thing, unless you're from Florida and have a problem with Chads. Mm-hmm. Or if it's a, you know, paper ballot, you see it. It's there. You know what you checked. It's a card. I have no idea what's in that card.
But so how does the data get transferred to the county?
They transport the cards, but they also have mechanisms where they can dial in the results from the precincts to the counties.
So it gets transferred
electronically.
Yeah, and then verified supposedly by reaccumulating the cards at the county level. So those are checking, but the problem with that double check, I thought you mentioned a very important point, two or more independent means. What you're double checking there is the previous unverifiable results, because you don't know what's on the cards. It's actually your votes.
Right.
So that the double check at that point is irrelevant, because the chain of custody is already broken between the voter and the
ballot. And you got something from the Princeton study?
Well, actually, let me start with a piece of anecdotal evidence. Of course, every Yahoo off the street has one of these. A good friend of mine that works for the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, she's got a friend in Ohio who was a poll worker, another PhD chemist, who in Ohio, they actually had a separate machine where you could take your card out, plug it into this machine, and just have it check what you voted for. It was just, you know, another machine to make sure nothing was doctored. So you could double check it. You plug it in there, and actually she witnessed several people's voting switched. So I'm not advocating a great conspiracy theory. Maybe mm-hmm. that's what it was. It could have been a glitch. I used to work for IBM, and in a minute we're going to talk about this Diebold patch to the software. There was a time when on the RISC 6000, IBM was putting a patch in every 2 days. I mean, updates to software, that's a common thing. It doesn't mean there's a conspiracy theory. But I think what you're referring to is this article by Ariel Feldman, J. Alex Halderman, no Nixon-era pun implied, and Edward W. Felton, entitled Security Analysis of the Diebold AccuVote TS Voting System. And we're not going to go through this because it's 24 pages long. You can find it at itpolicy.princeton.edu-voting. I don't think we have a connection here, but I will put one up on the website. And this is the thing people have been upset about over the last month or so. It just came out in September of 2006, and they basically say there are lots of vulnerabilities to these voting machines. What are the basic vulnerabilities?
Well, that's right. In fact, that they demonstrated how to hack them and reprogram them, and literally on video camera. Mm-hmm. Now, the irony about that, though, is that only corroborates a series of reports that are probably as high as the table we're at here, mm-hmm. that from all the universities around the country that are basically have said the same thing before, that the machines have literally dozens and in some cases hundreds of vulnerabilities where they are subject to manipulation. Mm-hmm. So the unique thing about the Princeton study is that they showed you how to do it, whereas the other studies didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the most significant thing about that particular study. And you'd ask me another question, and I had a memory dump there and forgot what I was going
to
say.
Well, why don't we really
give you a chance to retrieve that? We've got to take a break now. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM. You can call in at 404-943-1620 or toll-free 866-356-0789.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Garland Favorito about security issues in electronic voting. So you mentioned that not only the Princeton study, but the thing that made them unique was they taped it. Lots of universities and other organizations have pointed out.
And not only the universities, and I forgot to mention, but we actually, there are four states have officially concluded that the machines and procedures used in Georgia would be inadequate to conduct elections in their states.
And in fact, some independent body gave Georgia, what, an F as a grade for security issues?
Yes, Free Congress Foundation gave Georgia an F.
Worst was a F- nation, which was about a CC plus.
C plus, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, how do you get an F minus?
Well, we should know.
You're
right?
Worse than the country.
For me, it's not showing up to class. That's really a thing.
F minus, though?
So what are the natures of these security issues? I mean, basically, in looking through this article, someone who knows something about the software and hardware, and this is all off-the-shelf technology, and Bill and I agreed that the program that accumulates these votes is CS101. It takes a digital event, which is this touch screen, and it puts it in some array somewhere, just records it, right? So can you tell us what are the typical vulnerabilities?
Sure. Well, first of all, we don't even really like the word security because, you know, you can take these 25,000 machines, you can stick them in a warehouse, guard them by all four branches of the American military, you can have the most secure machines in the world, but that doesn't mean they count right.
So
voting machine security is kind of the word that we're using now, and that actually was pointed out as a concern in 88% of the people who responded to a recent survey. They thought that was an important issue. But getting back to the vulnerabilities, I think that they're so laid out about the hacking and everything that what we're trying to do is, rather than to go off onto a tangent where you could go into every kind of vulnerability day after day after day, hour after hour, we're just trying to focus on the fact that you can't verify, audit, or recount an election, and those are really the three vulnerabilities, and we should never have those. Mm-hmm. So let's fix those rather than to try to...
Okay, worry about all the software
to worry about how it can be manipulated. We know that it can, and we know that we can't verify the votes. Right. We know that we can't audit the votes, and we know that we can't recount the votes. So let's fix these three problems, and regardless of the technologies being implemented, and then we should have a reasonably secure solution.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you and I discussed on a phone call was we've gone from some percentage of verifiability with the punch cards to...
Right.
0%.
Yes.
Now,
yeah. So. That's an interesting point. That's very good. And actually, the state has agreed with us to some extent in our lawsuit, which we've filed. We've recently gotten a response back. You can see that lawsuit up on voterga.org. But that's a great point because prior to electronic voting, 82% of the votes were auditable, and because they used punch card and optical scan equipment. And when we moved to electronic voting, we reduced that percentage from 82% auditability to zero. And that's part of the reason why F minus.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let me throw in something, too. I read this book last year called Thomas Jefferson's Second Revolution, and it's about the election of 1800. Without getting too long-winded on this, we didn't know how to have an election in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We had, essentially, you'd have...
Well, you're right. It's not like we had experience in Great Britain.
No. So we had...
It's a new thing.
So for the Federalist Party, you had a president and a vice presidential candidate.
Right.
And for what this author called the Republican Party, which I thought it started with Lincoln, but anyway, the Republican Party had Thomas Jefferson as presidential candidate and Aaron Burr as vice president. Mm-hmm. and votes came in, and so it was towards the Jefferson Aaron Burr ticket.
Yes, the first vice president to get in trouble for shooting a gun.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just.
But the yeah, it was not a hunting accident.
Yeah.
But so he, you know, so it was this gentleman's agreement thing where they'd withhold one of the votes for the vice presidential candidate, the Electoral College would, and so then Thomas Jefferson would have one more vote than Aaron Burr. And well, Aaron Burr, being the sneaky individual that he was, he told the people in New York State that South Carolina was going to withhold a vote.
Right.
And he told the people in South Carolina that people in New York were going to withhold a vote. The votes came in, deadlock, tied, between Thomas Jefferson and his vice presidential running mate, Aaron Burr. It got thrown into the House of Representatives, according to what the Constitution says, unlike having it thrown into the Supreme Court, as we did in 2000, and they had 40 votes. 40 times they went through before they finally, you know, struck a deal and said, okay. And then 2 or 3 years after that, we had a constitutional amendment. So my point is that, A, we didn't know how to do it. We learned along the way.
Right.
And it was worth getting it right.
Yeah,
it was very much worth getting it. If it took an extra month, it took an extra month.
Right.
You know, and so this idea that, oh, we got to, you know, it's Tuesday night, you know, we got to go ahead and have this done and over with. To heck with it. This is something you absolutely have to get right, regardless of what the outcome is.
But what's coming out of here, I think, is a very different point, one that doesn't stress the technology. And I agree. I don't think the technology is the issue, because you can make the improvements based on the Princeton article. But it will always be hackable by the guy with the key who wrote the software.
Right.
This is why, by the way, the Gaming Commission in Vegas has a lot more independent security procedures for these video poker machines than we do. They take the license and name. All these guys that work on these machines and write the software are registered, and that's how they catch them. When they suddenly put some money in their bank account and they see these sorts of things happening. So don't we deserve the same security procedures as Vegas?
Absolutely.
I would think. But I think what Garland is saying is it'll always be hackable. So we should try to address that. But what you want is the verifiable, auditable trail.
Right. There's two things. And that raises a very good point, because the audit, the first thing is to get the audit trail. In other words, all the machines can produce a voter verifiable ballot.
Right.
But to your point, the question is, well, what do you do with that ballot? A lot of the states just say, okay, we have the audit trail, but they never use it to verify that the machines counted accurately on Election Night.
Right.
So what we have proposed is an audit procedure. And we have several different audit procedures. And in fact, one of them actually was one of the individuals who wrote this bill that is right here in Sandy Springs, Harry Geisinger. And so he actually came up with this on his own, but he basically has an audit procedure where we will verify that each machines count correctly on election night. So we'll take one race, for example, and verify that the machine counted that race, all the machines counted that race successfully on election night.
Right.
And rather than wait on right now they certify these things months in advance, and the machines can count differently on election nights, which we demonstrated and Princeton demonstrated.
Right.
So what they'll do, if you work the math out on all that, every race would be verified in every county on an average of twice if every precinct did the same thing. So you'd have a reasonable assurance that the machines could not be programmed to count differently, and it would only take about 30 minutes to do that in the precinct on election night if you had the proper technology.
Right.
Now, the issue right now is we don't have the proper technology on the pilot project.
Right. So you're suggesting
we need to take another break here.
Okay.
You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs. And AM 1620.
All right, welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Garland Favorito about security issues in voting. And now we really need to sum up in the next few minutes what we've learned. And I guess the big question is, are these e-voting machines even worth it? Why not go back to paper ballots where you had the independently verifiable auditable trail? And you had suggested, Bill had talked about optical scanners. You know, just like the SAT, you mark the little bubble with your pencil. You can see it. You know what you marked. And then
maybe say a little bit. Well, we've kind of lost track of explaining the simple things. But an optical scanner, basically, you get an image of that, and you see where it was that it was marked, and so then it becomes digitized or becomes, you know.
Right. It measures the dark pencil mark. Scantron
right.
is what
right,
people typically
right. So, so I mean, obviously, you know, people are okay with this for, you know, standardized tests and that kind of thing. So essentially it would be like that.
Right, and that's the most cost-effective solution that the legislature seems to like, because you only have to put one in every precinct versus having 10 or 20 DREs in every precinct, mm-hmm. which are almost as much as one optical scan. The only issue there is that we have to try to maintain a way for the visually impaired to vote independently through
right.
voice prompts.
Right.
So you could combine that with a ballot marking device.
Right.
For
you
them.
Could have one equivalent of the electronic voting machine that has voice prompts that literally physically marks a ballot for them. And that way
right.
you've got two machines instead of 25 still.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So you could...
And so Bill and I, we're geeks. We're big advocates of modern
yeah.
technology. But here's
right.
an example where modern technology may not be the answer.
Yeah. Again, you know, getting back to the election of 1800, it's worth getting right.
Right.
Whether it's old school, right. no technology, or high tech, it's worth getting it right.
And let me see if I can get our basic conclusion here. It seems to me that what's coming out of this is procedure is the big issue. It doesn't matter how you do it. You just have to have something that's verifiable. I can look at it. It's not that little card that I can't read into. And something that, if after the fact somebody claims that, you know, some ne'er-do-well like Bill was tampering with the election, they can go back, break the sealed box open, and count them again.
Exactly. So basically, the technological issue is that you need the audit trail to be established
right.
first. Then you've got the procedural issue of having an audit procedure to at the precinct level to make sure that those mm-hmm. are counted correctly, so that the votes are verified at the precinct and then go up into the final totals, rather than having the government tell you from the top down what your totals were at the precinct.
Right. Right.
Then the third thing that we are seeking in a lawsuit is that if you do find discrepancies at the precinct, that the candidates would be entitled to a recount of that race, as you said,
right.
at no charge to the candidates or mm-hmm. the parties involved.
Right.
Those are basic things you would think would already be in any election law, but they are not here in Georgia.
Right.
So we're hoping to get some of those installed next time, and hopefully with people right. like Harry Geisinger here, we'll be able to get that done.
So there you have it. The solution is not technological, as it so often is on our show. It's more procedural.
Well, which is sort of gets to a scientific method aspect of independent confirmation of what you've measured, what you believe
okay.
you've measured. So.
All right. Well, there you have it. Garland Favorito, thank you so much for being on the program.
It was an honor.
We'll be back next week. I'm not – who are we talking to next week? We don't even know yet. We're not sure. Somebody
yeah, we're
good.
Not sure. Somebody knowledgeable about something.
And if you are one of our Georgia Tech students listening, our guest from 3 weeks ago, Lou Lefton, will actually be appearing with me doing some comedy at the Britain Dorms on Sunday at 7 p.m. Other than that, we'll be back next week with Inside the Black Box. And coming up, what's the shopping spree show?
Coming up is Garden Party, and following Garden Party is a shopping spree.
There you go.
With great deals.
We'll see you next week.